Genesis 2 is centered around specific events. So it unpacks some events. In Genesis chapter 1, look at verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. They will rule the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, the livestock, all the earth, and the creatures that crawl on the earth." Verse 27, so God created man in his own image. He created him in the image of God. So thus far we just have Adam. But then, the next line, he created them, male and female. And so you have in this one 24-hour day both the creation of Adam and the creation of Eve. So in Genesis 2, when it tells of that account, it says that in the Adam had been created, was given the assignment to name all the animals, and then Eve was created. So when you read Genesis 2 in light of Genesis 1, Genesis 1 puts that in a 24-hour period. Now, let me just say, I don't think it's impossible for Adam to name all the animals in 24 hours, and here's why. God just created the world. For God to make it possible for Adam to name 24 animals is certainly possible. I just think that that's a point of for us to pause and say, is this a 24-hour period? I think that's one reason to maybe question our certainty that it is. But I don't think it's a final blow to a view of six 24-hour consecutive days. But I think it's reason to stop and say, well, is that a 24-hour period? Now, if God wanted him to name them in 24 hours and to also experience loneliness and to have that culminate in Eve being created, he certainly could have done that. And so one of the things when I'm with my, I have an uncle who was a true skeptic for years. My mom shared the gospel with him, prayed for him for years and years and years. His name's Kevin. And just recently, in the last 2 years, he became a believer after 30 years of prayer and sharing the gospel. And I'll share his story in a second because it's kind of cool. But I would go up north. He's in Upper Peninsula, Michigan, and hang out with my aunt and uncle. And we would go out fishing for walleye, which is the kind of fish they fish for there. And you fish with the leeches if you've never fished for walleye. I guess you could use other things. But while we were out fishing, my uncle would always say to me, "So, Danny, do you really believe a big fish swallowed a guy and then spit him up, vomited him up a few days later?" And I would, and he would go through like all the miracles, and I would just say, "Well, Kevin, Uncle Kevin, I believe God spoke and created the world, everything. So could a fish swallow a man? That's really not a big deal." And so going from greater to lesser miracles, which I would say the creation of the world is a greater miracle and Jonah's a lesser miracle. If you accept the greater miracle, then the lesser miracle is not that big of a deal. So if you believe God created the world, as I do, then Adam naming the animals in 24 hours would not be a problem. But I do think it's a good point for us to consider when you're working through whether or not you believe they were six 24-hour days. I have a lot of friends who hold that view here, and I have some friends on faculty here who don't hold that view, and then a lot of friends at other places who don't hold the view. I have equal respect for both of them. They probably have less respect for me than I have for them because I kind of like waver between two opinions. But my main point that I want to emphasize would be I just think that we're on dangerous ground when we're too dogmatic about it. That doesn't mean we can't have opinions about it. Now, we are not, I think, but I also think we're on dangerous ground when we give up a historical Adam, the special creation of Adam. Does that make sense? Okay. Want everybody to make sure we're all on the same page. Okay, I want to start the second, I want to call it a lecture, but that sounds too boring, the second exciting presentation, which is, the title of this is The Gospel Gives Explanation for Our Existence. And we're going to look at Colossians 1. And I want to give you a story from my childhood to kind of illustrate this. I became a Christian when I was 15, grew up in a Christian home. I'm 35 now. This is the 20-year anniversary of me becoming a Christian. And I actually get to speak at the camp this year where I became a Christian. It's their 20-year anniversary as well. So the camp ministry I was saved at is called LIFT, L-I-F-T, Student Ministries. I'm speaking back there at Cedarville University here in a couple weeks. And anyway, so it's part of my testimony, but I won't give you all the details of that. I could chase rabbits, and that's certainly not a rabbit, but I want to stay on task. So I became a Christian at the age of 15. And I went to a public school, and I grew up going to the Christian school for elementary school, My parents let me decide for myself for junior high, so I went to the public school, got in a lot of trouble, and a lot of trouble. And my parents sent me to the Christian school to reform me. And while I was there, and they had good intentions, that sounded bad, but that was part of it. You know, they want me in a more structured environment. While I was there, I was exposed to the gospel in a very powerful way because I'd heard it my whole life when I was 15. And came back and my parents gave me an option of where I would go at that point. So I went back to the public school and actually started a Bible study in my public high school with a couple of my best friends. And that Bible study continued for several years. I don't know if it's still functioning today, but had a great experience there. So the age of 17 now, a couple years later, I thought I was going off to art camp because I've always been artsy, yet manly at the same time. So I liked art stuff, but I like to, you know, kill wild animals and field dress, you know, a deer or whatever and eat it. So manly, but yet artsy. And so I thought I was going to go study graphic design, and that was where I thought I was headed. And so I spent some time at Eastern Illinois University, and they had a summer program. So I was chosen for my high school. They chose one student to scholarship for art camp, and it was me. And so long story short, at the age of 17, thought I was going to art camp, but was feeling called to ministry, but was still trying to reconcile what I was hearing in the public school about certain things with my Christian worldview. And I was blessed to have a Christian principal, a lot of Christian teachers, but I'm still hearing things that didn't fit nice and neatly within my view of the world. And I remember this one specific trip to the mall, and I'm from Central Illinois. It was 20 miles to the nearest shopping mall, 20 miles of interstate framed by corn and soybean fields all the way. I lived out in the middle of the country. And so we drove into the mall, and on most mall trips, you know, we were there for mixed reasons. Part of it was, you know, that was the one cool place to go. Wanted to meet a girl while we were there. I mean, it's just like the excitement of you're in the town, you're in the city. But on this particular trip, I was on a mission because there was a scientist whose book I really wanted to read. And I was 17 at the time, and I just wanted to be able to tell my friends I had read his book. And it was a book by an author named Stephen Hawking. And the title of the book was A Brief History of Time. And, you know, I was a true pseudo-intellectual then, and I'm still a true pseudo-intellectual today. I just wanted to say I'd read it. And I realized quickly that most people who wanted to read that book wanted to read it for the same reason I did, which was not as much to read the book, it was to tell other people you had read the book and to look smart. So I sat down cross-legged in the middle of these book aisles and started reading Stephen Hawking describing black matter and black holes and all kinds of stuff. My eyes glazed over. And so I'm skimming through the book. And so I forgot most of what I read except for what he writes in the final chapter of the book, almost the final words of the book. In the book, he talks about finding what he calls a toe. And I'm thinking as a 17-year-old, well, I've found my toe. You know, I didn't have to have a degree in rocket science to find it. But toe is an abbreviation for a theory of everything. And so Stephen Hawking is on a quest, as all philosophers and all scientists have been throughout the centuries, people like Albert Einstein, and you could go through several other names. They've always wanted to find, and even today, a theory of everything, one simple theory that explains all of reality. And here's what Stephen Hawking said in his book. He's an atheist, by the way. More outspoken now than he was back then, but not more an atheist now. He was an atheist when he wrote this several years ago. He says, however, if we discover a complete theory, it should be in time be understandable by everyone, not just a few scientists. Then we shall all, philosophers, scientists, and just ordinary people, be able to take part in the discussion of the question of why it is that we and the universe exist. So he's saying, if we find this theory, it will be simple, like a child will be able to understand it. We can all be involved in this conversation. It'll have to be something that it's taken a long time to find, but once we find it, it'll have to be something so simple that anybody can understand it. Here's his final line. If we find the answer to that, it will be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we should know the mind of God. You know, the Christian preacher is so arrogant as to stand behind a pulpit every week and say he knows what Stephen Hawking, the world-renowned scientist, doesn't know, that he does know the mind of God. Not because he's smart, but because God has revealed it to him in his Son, in his creation, and in his Word. And so the gospel gives an explanation for why we are here, and I believe it's a plausible explanation. I believe it's a better explanation than atheism offers. And so I want us to consider this explanation. And the Apostle Paul opens the book of Colossians by giving them a theory of everything. So I want us to consider this, Colossians chapter 1, and we're going to start in verse 15. We're going to see that Paul is going to get to a place in chapter 2 where he warns the Colossian believers, the believers in Colossae, where he warns them about plausible arguments, deceptive philosophy, and he recognized they were in a secular culture where people were challenging their views. But before he gets to all of that, he presents the gospel as the grand theory that explains all of reality. And so here in Colossians chapter 1, verse 15, Paul writes, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For everything was created by him in heaven and on earth, the visible and the invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and by him all things hold together. He is also the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he might come to have first place in everything. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile everything to himself by making peace through the blood of his cross, whether things on earth or things in heaven." So the Apostle Paul points to the gospel here as the great explanation for all of reality. Long before he'll get to plausible arguments or deceptive philosophy, he begins by saying that the Christian need not be ashamed of the gospel as the power to save sinners or as the gospel as the power to understand reality. He says, if you want to understand the world around us, that Jesus, in verse 15, is the image of the invisible God, that he is over all things created, invisible and visible. Now, the great problem for atheists, there are other synonyms for atheists, and they're not perfect synonyms because there's nuances and differences, but here I'll give you a few. If you ever hear the term naturalist, okay, there can be other understandings and definitions of naturalists, and I won't give you all those, but one is some good, some bad. One way naturalism is used is someone who says there's nothing but nature. There's nothing outside of nature. So they have a natural explanation of the universe. There's nothing outside of nature they point to explain nature itself. Another term for that would be materialists. Now, I don't mean like Madonna's old song, "I am a material world living in a material," or "material girl living in a material world." You guys haven't even heard that song or probably don't even know who Madonna is. But it's not materialism like money. It's that nothing exists outside of matter. Okay, so you have nothing exists outside of nature, nothing exists outside of matter. There's a famous atheist by the name, he's now dead. His name's Carl Sagan, and he did this documentary a long time ago called Cosmos. And he begins his documentary by saying, "The cosmos is all there is, or was, or ever will be." And he's making an argument for naturalism or materialism. It's just all of his references for what explanations for reality is based inside the material world. The Berenstain Bears, more philosophical writings, they begin their book, The Big Book of Nature. And the first line of that book, as you'll read about in Nancy Piercy, she's the one who introduced me to this. I didn't realize it until I read her book. They begin their big book of nature with, "Nature is all there is, or was, or ever will be." And you could tell they are, in that book, the people who wrote that specific work, they are propagating, or they're preaching, or they're trying to get you to adopt a naturalistic explanation of the world. Here's one of the biggest problems with that. The biggest problem is that it's not true. Okay? That's a problem. But here's the challenge that any atheist who holds... Now, there's some atheists who believe that there's some guiding force behind the world, but it's not God, and it's not... It gets confusing, but there's some people kind of deify mathematics, that the laws of mathematics are really what are guiding it all. And so it kind of becomes a little pantheistic, and anyways, there are atheists who are open to something beyond matter, but it becomes really hard to defend. So most atheists kind of default into a position that the cosmos is all there is or was or ever will be, or nature is all there is or was or ever will be. The problem with that is you have to deny the vast majority of typical human experience if that's true. So if that's true, is love, for example, something that has a material substance? Is beauty something that has purely a natural explanation? I mean, is there some survivable reason why we're more drawn to beauty? I mean, does it really, you know, I've been in a lot of places in the world, a lot of beautiful places, whether it's the desert, whether it's the forest. I don't find beauty providing any better survival traits. I mean, so if we had to describe beauty completely in terms of some natural explanation, why exactly is it that the world is filled with so much beauty? Things like altruism. Altruism means doing good for others, even at your own expense. So the fact that altruism, that we do things for other people who are outside of our family, that doesn't seem to fit within Darwinian evolution. There are a number of other things, like philosophical ideas. Because they don't have a material explanation, does that mean they're delusions? So Stephen Hawking, I'll give you one quick example, who I read that quote from, wrote a recent book called The Grand Design. And the main point of that book, of The Grand Design, was to prove that there's not a grand designer. So it's kind of a farce, because he really argues there's not a grand design, even though the book's called The Grand Design. In the opening pages of that book, he makes this statement: philosophy is dead. Here's the main problem with that, okay? That is a philosophical statement. So do you guys see where that, it's like it doesn't fit. And so if you're going to build a case against philosophy, you have to build it on philosophical grounds, which, so by its own measure, it is false. If philosophy is dead, that statement is dead, which means it's false. So philosophy is not dead based on its own statement. You know, Aristotle had certain rules of logic, and one was called the law of non-contradiction. It's one of the most basic rules of logic. If something contradicts itself, it's probably not true, and that contradicts itself. And so if you're stuck within trying to explain everything from naturalistic explanations, it's really tough, right? I'm not saying people don't try. So Sam Harris just published a book. He published a book right... He didn't just publish it. He published it right after 9/11. And it was the first of the atheist attacks against Christianity. And his book is called The End of Faith. Sam Harris recently published a book called The Moral Landscape. And The Moral Landscape is an attempt to try to prove from scientific grounds that morality, you can have morality within an evolutionary view. Because here's the real problem. If everything has a material explanation, and I'm spending more time on this than I meant to, but maybe there's a good reason for that. If everything has a material explanation, then how do we explain morality? See, for materialism to be false, and by materialism I mean atheism or naturalism, we only need one thing that doesn't have a material explanation. We just need one thing. I mean, if morality cannot be explained from some physical, scientific way, then materialism is false. Now, what atheists will say to you, and I didn't mean to give you as many coaching tips if you're talking to an atheist, but they'll say, well, science hasn't explained it yet. And so they'll keep saying that at some point science will explain it. But here's Sam Harris, his book, The Moral Landscape. It is the biggest work trying to do this. It is filled with philosophical assumptions. It's not science, it's philosophy. So again, like Stephen Hawking, he has a hard time explaining the non-material aspects of human existence. I mean, just to be human, we experience all these non-material things every day that are meaningful to us. Our longing for transcendence, our longing for the supernatural. The fact that the vast majority of humans throughout all of civilization have believed in God would all have to be a delusion. There must not be anything there. Paul says here in Colossians 1, in verse 16, that everything was created by him in heaven and on earth, the visible and the invisible. See, the gospel accounts for the non-material aspects of the human experience. I know some of these phrases and concepts may be difficult. Is everybody tracking? You feel like you're Okay, the gospel provides a basis for what materialism can't, while there is non-material aspects to the human life that are extremely important. Okay, Edgar H. Andrews. I'm going to give you his title. I don't know what it means. He is at the University of London, and he is the professor of materials at the University of London. He suggests this: a true theory of everything, therefore, must embrace both material and non-material aspects of the universe. Does the gospel do that? Yes. He goes on to say, and my contention, okay, this is the professor of materials, emeritus at the University of London, smart guy, my contention is that we already possess such a theory, namely the hypothesis of God. That God seems to supply a rational explanation for the world we live in. And Paul says, Jesus is the one who created all things material and immaterial. So the gospel gives explanation for our existence. When you talk to skeptics, there are two miracles that I typically will try to share, and I'll try to focus on these two miracles and really not, and other miracles that are directly connected to them, and here they are. The first is the creation account of the world. And I mentioned earlier, kind of in joking about my uncle, and I'll go ahead and tell you his story now, that if you start with the greater miracles, to move to the lesser miracles, if you accept the creation of the world, then to accept that Adam can name the animals in 24 hours is kind of insignificant. To accept the creation of the world, to accept that a whale could swallow a man and vomit him on dry land, isn't that big of a deal, right? To accept the creation of the world and believe that Jesus walked on water is not that big of a deal, because if God created the waves, the most natural thing for them to do would be to obey the Son of God. So that the waves were not acting unnaturally when Jesus walked on water. They were doing the most natural thing that they were created to do, and that was to be brought under dominion of the Lord Jesus Christ. And so creation is the first miracle I'll focus on. I'll tell you the second in just a minute, but let me tell you my uncle's story. My Uncle Kevin, I mentioned how he was always just a true skeptic, but open, oddly enough, to the supernatural. And the way that manifested itself in his life is that he would watch, and he's a very intelligent guy, so I'm not sharing this to say, like, you know, he was silly or something about it. But he would watch the shows on the TLC channel or whatever about haunted houses. And we'd have discussions about, do you believe this is possible? You know, the house could be haunted. Well, I believe the supernatural is real, and I believe that there's a real Satan and real demons and real spiritual battle. I don't believe in the way they present it in the show, but I would say that, a lot of that kind of stuff is probably related to spiritual activity. And so we'd have discussions like that, and but it would always end there. He didn't want to talk about religion, but he was kind of open to something outside of nature. Well, my mom sent my aunt Tony, tough lady. If you meet a lady named Tony, don't mess with her. My aunt's a very tough Italian lady and very sweet as well. But my mom sent her a copy of a book. The book is written by a theologian whose father was an atheist. And he wrote his dad a letter and just was burdened for him and wanted to see him come to faith in Christ. And his father wrote back with all of his deep and well-thought-out questions with Christianity. So this isn't like evangelism made easy. This is like evangelism made really messy and really hard. It's a real skeptic. It's a dad and a son. Now, I have to preface it by saying the theologian is a theologian I don't agree with on a lot of points of theology. So I'm going to tell you his name, but I'm going to say that with the preface that I don't support everything he believes or teaches or that you might find online by him. But his name is Greg Boyd, and he has a lot of issues with his theology, and I don't want to minimize those. But I really admire the way he shared the gospel with his dad. So my mom sent the book to my aunt. Okay, my aunt and my uncle make long drives across Upper Peninsula, Michigan, which is beautiful. Anybody from Michigan? Okay, so you're probably from somewhere on the hand, and the UP is off the hand, you know, and it's like another hand somewhere. I forget where. Yeah, there. I don't know. So they go for these long drives, and the UP is beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous. And my aunt was reading the book, and my uncle's intrigued. Like, what are you reading? And she said, I'm reading this book, and it's about a pastor whose dad's not a believer. And he said, well, read it to me. So she would read while my uncle was driving. And she would begin, you know, it got to the point where the dad writes back. And so the dad writes back and says, these are all the objections I have with Christianity. And my uncle goes, yeah, Those are the same objections I have with Christianity. So my aunt would read Greg Boyd's response, and my uncle would say, I never thought about that. So she'd read the next chapter, and he'd say, well, that's how I felt all my life. This guy's putting words in my, you know, taking the words right out of my mouth. He's saying what I've always thought. And then Greg would write back, and my aunt would read it, and he'd say, well, that's a really good point. I never thought about that. So after several car trips and several discussions about this book, they get to the end, and Greg Boyd's dad says to his son, I'm convinced there's a God. And it just seems so, it seems to make sense, and the history seems to point to the fact that there's a real Jesus, man named Jesus who died, and the best explanation, given the historical data we have, it seems that he rose from the dead. And I've come to accept that as fact. What must I do to be saved? And this is really, if you read the book, and so my aunt's reading that, my uncle goes, well, yeah, I believe there's a God now too, and I believe that the best historical evidence we have is that Jesus must have risen from the dead, and what must I do to be saved? And my aunt said, well, let me read the next chapter. And so she reads Greg Boyd's response. And my uncle, I don't know if it was there in the car or later on, but prayed to receive Christ. And so I share that story simply to share the fact that the Apostle Paul is setting the stage here, not by giving them intellectual ammunition. He's just saying, look at the gospel. The gospel just seems to make sense of the world we live in a way that other worldviews don't. So creation is the most important miracle, and the next one might surprise you, because every other miracle is contingent on that one, right? If God didn't create the world, then whether or not the flood happened doesn't matter, because if God didn't create the world, it's contingent on the creation having happened. The second one is the incarnation. I would say, if I was asked, what is the single most important miracle, I would say it's the resurrection. But the resurrection is contingent on the incarnation. The incarnation is God taking on human flesh. And so these two miracles, I believe, help frame our presentation of the gospel, but they also are connected, surprisingly enough, by the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. So I want you to turn there really quick and see how the Apostle Paul connects the creation of the world with the incarnation of the Son. The two most important miracles, for every other miracle is contingent upon these. That God created the world and that God has visited us in our suffering. Even the resurrection itself is, of course, contingent upon the fact that God has visited mankind. So 2 Corinthians chapter 4. The Apostle Paul writes in verse 3. Paul writes, but if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this age, Satan himself, has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ. And I want to stop right there, and the Apostle Paul, and point out, Paul is not saying if people don't believe our message, it's because we're not smart enough, or we're not savvy enough with cultural ways. Paul says if they don't understand the gospel, it's because their hearts are blinded. And so Paul is saying, look, there are people who are smart, who are moral, who are caring, and who reject the gospel, not because they're not intelligent enough, not because we're not intelligent enough, but because their eyes are blinded to the gospel. And so we need to recognize, living as Christians in a secular culture, that we are surrounded by people who are blinded to the very foundation to which we are building our lives upon. And for Paul, he says it's the gospel. He goes on here and says in verse 5, for we are not proclaiming ourselves, but Jesus Christ is Lord, and ourselves as your slaves because of Jesus. Verse 6, for God, who said, let light shine out of darkness. This is a direct quote from the Old Testament. What book of the Bible do you think it comes from? Genesis. So what is Paul pointing to here? He's pointing to the creation of the world. So for God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone in our hearts. So something about God, the God who created the world, is still working in humanity today. So this light is shone in our hearts, to give the light of the knowledge of God's glory in the face of Jesus Christ. Now, I want you to see a really beautiful parallel between the creation account that I believe Paul's drawing here, the creation account and the incarnation. When Jesus was baptized, it was on the heels of a long period of darkness in Jewish history. After the Old Testament closed, there was no prophets for hundreds of years. It was a time of spiritual darkness. John the Baptist came as one declaring the way of the Lord in the wilderness. He was not the light, but he came to testify of the light. Jesus came out to John, and John baptized him. That inaugurated Jesus' public ministry. Remember the Genesis account. The Spirit of God descended upon the face of the waters, and God said, "Let there be light." Think about Jesus' baptism. You have Jesus at a time of spiritual darkness stepping into the baptismal waters, and you have the Spirit of God descending upon the face of the waters, and you have God proclaim, "This is my Son in whom I'm well pleased." It's just beautiful how it all ties together. And so Paul says here, "For God who commanded the light to shine out of darkness hath shone in our hearts to do what? To give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory in the face of Jesus Christ." I'm going to give you three quick theological terms that I think explain the Christian theory of everything. It's creation, incarnation, and regeneration. Creation, incarnation, and regeneration. The Christian theory of everything is summarized in those three words. Paul said, "For God who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, creation, has led us to understand the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ, incarnation. But in the middle of that, this light has shone in our hearts." Regeneration is the new birth that comes from encountering Jesus Christ in faith and repentance. And so here we see that that is the Christian theory of everything. The Christian theory of everything is that God, who created the world, has visited us in our suffering that we might have new life. And Paul says, look, you're going to meet really smart people. We're going to meet them in chapter 2. You're going to meet really smart people who have plausible arguments and deceptive philosophy. Paul counters all of these things with his PhD and all of his books he's written. Of course not. He counters them all with the simple gospel of Jesus Christ. And he says in Colossians 1, you know what? God created everything, material and immaterial. I want to read a couple quotes to you really quick. The world around us embraces other theories. That should not surprise us, right? They embrace other theories of why there's something rather than nothing. And yet, there have been even those who've been willing, who are not believers, who've been willing to point out that Christianity seems to explain the world around them, even while rejecting Christianity. One such person is Robert Jastrow, J-A-S-T-R-O-W. He's now... I almost said he went to be with the Lord. He didn't die a believer, so he didn't go to be with the Lord. He's now dead. And he now knows, if he were here today, he would testify that everything I'm sharing about the gospel is true. Unfortunately, he would come to that conclusion too late. But he was the founder of NASA's Goddard Institute, and he considered science's limitation in explaining the origin of the universe to be itself evidence for the supernatural. And he said this, "All this happened as a product of forces they," referring to other scientists, "cannot hope to discover. That there are what I or anyone else would call supernatural forces at work is now, I think, a scientifically proven fact." And what he's saying is, look, there's so many things science can't explain, and that itself seems to be kind of an explanation, evidence for the fact that there's the supernatural. He said later in a book called God and the Astronomers, published... he died in 2008. I'm not sure when this book was published, but listen to this. It's really good. He said, "At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountain of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." Here's what he's saying. Look, we're working so hard, and it seems that the theologians may have a leg up on us. I understood, even as a 17-year-old sitting in that bookstore in the mall, that I actually knew something Stephen Hawking didn't, even though he knows a lot that I don't. What I know actually is far more important than what he knows. And I don't mean that in a condescending way, that I do know the mind of God, and that the gospel is the theory of everything that gives an explanation for our very existence.